Hello and welcome to the Technically Legal Podcast. This is episode 114 for August 23rd, 2011. I'm Ben Snitkoff.
And I'm David O'Brien.
And Dominic is out this week, and we had taken last week off, so it's good to be back. Not as usual. We've got two stories for you this week because we've got a reduced panel. First, we're going to talk about a pair of cases relating to jurisdiction and internet cases, specifically where you can bring a suit when you're suing a company that does business on the internet. And secondly, we're going to talk about a police department that thinks that they can detain photographers if the photographers are taking a picture without any, quote, apparent aesthetic value. So I guess to move right into this first question, this was an article from the 12th that we got over off of the Technology and Marketing Law blog by Eric Goldman, and this post was by Venkat Balasubramani, who's who posts very frequently on Eric Goldman's blog over there. And he brought our attention to two cases out of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which covers a lot of the Western United States. The first case was called Maverick Photo v. Brand Technologies, and a photo-based company that has a lot of ties to California brought suit against an Ohio company that runs a website called celebrity-gossip.net. It's a fairly well-trafficked web page. The website had run a photo that belonged to this photo company, and they did it without... the copyright relates to the lawsuit relates to copyright infringement. It's still at an early stage, so I don't want to go around saying that somebody copied the photo without permission, and we don't know if there's, you know, possibly a fair use defense here or something. But Maverick's photo brought suit against this website in California, and the website was based out of Ohio. It's an Ohio corporation. And this Ohio corporation moved to dismiss the suit because they didn't have any ties to California. Now, the Ninth Circuit came down with an interesting opinion here that basically said, because your website and because, you know, you're putting your website out to for anyone to access it on the internet, and because, you know, through third parties you have advertisers, you know, they said this website subscribed to an ad network. That ad network had people who bought ads that were targeted to Californians and served those ads to people in California. So the court read into that saying that, well, you know, we can infer that this online company had at least constructive notice that they had people who read their website in California. And again, you know, it's a website. It was, you know, open to pretty much anyone to go see. So that's enough connection with California for us to bring a lawsuit here. David, any initial thoughts?
Yeah, personal jurisdiction on the internet has kind of evolved over the last 15 years or so. There were a bunch of cases in the late 90s, I think, and maybe the early 2000s, but there have only been a handful, I think, since then that sort of address, or like a circuit-level opinion, which addresses the personal jurisdiction issue for websites and website-related activity.
Right. The case law has been kind of sparse of late. And interestingly, the Supreme Court dealt with two personal jurisdiction cases, and I'm blanking on the details of them right now. Neither of them was a dead-on case addressing personal jurisdiction over a company that does business on the internet. One of them related to something called general jurisdiction, which isn't really worth going into right now. It doesn't come up a lot. But the implication was that the two cases that the Supreme Court heard this year were kind of precursors to them finally addressing this issue of, you know, whether or not it's appropriate to sue an internet a company, you know, based in Ohio that does business on the internet in pretty much any state. Some of the tests that courts have used, one's called the effects test, which it comes from a case called Calder v. Jones, which essentially says, if you do some act and you know the effects of that act will be felt in some jurisdiction and you have, you know, some amount of ties to it. In this case, it was a tabloid that sold copies of their magazine in California. They were sued in California, and the libel that allegedly happened in this newspaper, the results of that would have been felt most directly in California. Therefore, it was okay to sue them in California. Here, we've got a company that really doesn't have any physical ties. There's a tie through a third party company that serves up their ads, but it seems really tenuous to say that they were taking advantage of the benefits of that jurisdiction. And that's another test that they use, whether or not you're availing yourself of the rights and benefits of the jurisdiction, in this case California. You know, if you're doing that, if you're, doing business in California, if you have agents who work in California, then it's typically okay to bring a suit against the person in California.
I think what bothers me about both of these cases is the fact that it doesn't really provide a whole lot of guidance for people as to whether they're likely to have personal jurisdiction in a particular state. And both of the opinions were written by the same judge, and yet it's still sort of wishy-washy about what works under which prong of analysis and what doesn't.
Right, and personal jurisdiction has always kind of been this nebulous thing. Initially, the fine line was, if you step foot in California, then the California courts have personal jurisdiction over you because you're clearly making use of the forum state. You're there. You're availing yourself of, all of the rights and benefits that come from being in California. Over time, I mean, that's obvious that, that couldn't stand because there are lots of companies that, have franchises in that area, but, the company themselves isn't based there. So you have to expand the test a little bit. But it seems like now the test is, have you, do, you know, does, did somebody load your web page in California? Yep. Okay. That's good enough.
Yeah,
Which
and
just.
the third party ad network thing is also kind of a crazy argument to assert that because you're part of a third party ad network, which means that another corporation that you're not related to except by way of a contractual agreement that allows them to put ads on your website, because that company puts ads on your website that may or may not be targeted to a person within a particular state that might give you jurisdiction. Weird.
Yeah, I mean, and it's worth noting that these are both at a very early stage. I believe these were both on motions to dismiss for lack of personal jurisdiction.
Yep.
So there's a pretty low bar that, in this case, the plaintiffs would have to hit. And, as the case goes on, the plaintiff's burden of proving that the court still has personal jurisdiction gets higher. The further you go along, the more evidence you actually have to prove. The more evidence you have to produce to prove this. Typically it's something that gets dropped after, after something like this. But I could see in this case the defendants still trying to pursue it, saying, yes, that they, the plaintiffs pled in their complaint that we have some notice over that we have constructive notice over who uses our website based on these third party ads, but in reality we don't. Here are our books. We don't get any information from them. All we get is a check every month, based on these ad sales. It doesn't tell us where these people are. And in the end, I don't know how much of an effect that will have because the court relied on other tests too to try to tilt the scales in favor of personal jurisdiction. I should also mention that there is a second case involved here, and that's called the College Source v. Academy one. And College Source has a significant digitized catalog of course catalogs from various colleges and universities. Academy One was a company that's basically trying to compete with that. First, they came to College Source and asked to license it. College Source declined, and then Academy One hired a third-party contractor to go out, and it was probably the Mechanical Turk or something like that, go out and get course catalogs from all of these colleges and then compile them into their own system. Through some method, some of the third parties got the course catalogs off of the plaintiff's site, College Source. And as a result, College Source sued Academy One for, oof, what were they actually sued for in this case?
Copyright infringement, I think.
Okay, but it's
Tortious
factual.
misappropriation of
There we go.
materials, Computer Fraud and Abuse Act.
Right, because they were being used for commercial use, and having a third party access a website for commercial purpose automatically imputes that liability onto you. There are some problems with this case. Not the least of all is that the access of these servers, College Source's servers, wasn't actually committed, as far as we can tell, by the defendant. So, if you hire some third party to do an act, third party happens to violate the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, suddenly there's personal jurisdiction over you. It's also very tenuous in my view. But it's also, this is a very different case because it involves, I mean, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act is a, I don't want to say like a physical act, but it's a more visceral tort than, something like copyright infringement. It actually involves there being an intrusion on, in this case, it's a server, but an intrusion on something that exists in physical space as opposed to copying an image.
Yeah, so another bizarre set of facts here, and another case that I feel like didn't really help, clarify any of the jurisdictional questions I might have.
Yeah, and I absolutely agree. Well, I mean, I agree and disagree. I think in the Ninth Circuit, there's, if you're a company that exists on the internet, you're now eligible to be sued anywhere in the Ninth Circuit, unless you have something that, actively excludes you from doing commerce in, the venue in which you're being sued, the state in which you're being sued. But it doesn't really clarify it as a whole across the country, and I would expect to see some sort of contraction of personal jurisdiction with regards to internet cases, especially because this opens you up to forum shopping, where, a California company could sue an Ohio company in Arizona because, Arizona law on this is slightly more favorable, or because, there's a judge that they want to have in Arizona. And this isn't all that different from what's going on in the Eastern District of Texas and what has been going on forever. You've got companies that hold patents, non-practicing entities that hold patents that have a physical office in Texas just so they can bring suits in Texas, not because any of the not because any of the witnesses are there or any real damage happened there. And interestingly, as a result of that, you're seeing more and more motions to remove the case to a different venue, motions for a change of venue happening and being allowed out of the Eastern District of Texas, because the Eastern District of Texas doesn't want all these cases, and it's not convenient for any of the parties in reality. Any last thoughts, David?
I think that's a really interesting point that you just made because that's got to be the tension that is in all of these cases that involve personal jurisdiction. Part of me really wants to be like, well, look, you're doing things on the internet, and if the allegations are between basically two companies that operate websites, websites are inherently viewable by the public anywhere. So that means that in any particular state, someone can access a website. That also says to me that you might likely get sued in any of those states, and so why don't we have like a broader rule where we don't have court opinions like these, which feel a bit tortured when going through the general jurisdictional analysis and then the specific jurisdiction analysis, and not really delineating terribly clearly between either of those two things. And if we just had a general rule which says, hey, you can get sued basically anywhere. If you have a website on the internet, your website's available in every state. Be aware of the fact that you get sued in any particular state. That would seem to make a little bit more sense, at least for the purposes of expectations and just understanding what is likely to happen to a particular person. But the tension is that there's the forum shopping issue, right? So if we did have that could mean that we would have some jurisdictions around the country in some states or in some federal jurisdictions where it's more favorable under those one state's laws to sue there, and for whether those are procedural reasons or whether those are actual substantive rulings of law that make it more attractive to sue there, that's something that we don't want, and it's also a problem that we already seem to have in the patent world, at least to some extent.
Right.
Okay, well, on that note, I will take us on to our second and last case of the day. This one comes from Long Beach, and recently the Long Beach Police Department has announced that they have a policy of detaining photographers who are taking pictures with no aesthetic value, and I'm not making that up. That is an actual quote from the statement that they gave to the media. And so we'll talk first about the incident that gave rise to this new policy. In June, a photographer was taking pictures of the Eddington Oil Company. It's a refinery or something in Long Beach. And while he was taking pictures, a police officer rolled up beside him on the road and asked him what he was doing. And according to the Long Beach Post, where we got this story from, he claimed that he said to the police officer that he was taking pictures for artistic reasons. And at this point, the officer asked the photographer to hand over his driver's license and to identify himself. And the photographer replied, "Well, do I have to?" And then the officer said, "Yes,
Interrupt you there
sure."
for a second and say that up until now, it varies from state to state, but in some states, nothing hinky has happened. In other states, you do actually have to have a reason to ask for somebody's identification. In other states, it's a matter of law of the state that up in, you can approach anyone in the public and ask them to identify themselves and ask for photo ID without any reasonable suspicion. But carry on.
Right, and that's an important point we'll hit again later. So the license goes over to the police officer, and the police officer goes back to his patrol car, runs a check, and then eventually, and meanwhile, by the way, the photographer's just sort of standing there, I guess, on the side of the road. And it's not very clear, but I sort of gathered from the article I was reading on the Long Beach Post that the photographer was taking pictures from a public location. It wasn't like he was necessarily trespassing. Anyway, the officer comes back, hands back the license, says everything's okay, and then everyone goes home. And then it later came out, I guess, that the photographer was, in fact, I guess he is a journalist, perhaps a freelance journalist, occasionally sells his pictures to the Long Beach Post and other newspapers in the area. It's worth noting that over the last 10 years, really since September 11th, there have been a lot of reports around the country of photographers being subjected to similar treatment for taking pictures of bridges, tunnels, highways, areas near public transportation, oil refineries, or national infrastructure, basically, wherever national infrastructure resides. So, Ben, you jumped right on this right away. What do you think that the First Amendment implications here are, if there are any?
I'd be more concerned with the Fourth Amendment implications than the First Amendment implications, but I mean, there's obviously a First Amendment, kind of chilling effect that you're going to be concerned about. Photography is a protected form of expression, and if you're threatening to detain photographers for taking a picture, it's up to the subjective determination, according to their policy, of the police officers to whether or not this picture has an aesthetic value. First of all, I don't trust any police officer to understand exactly what's going on with the photograph based on, just looking at the photographer. If you show, if the average police officer can tell me the difference by looking at it, by looking at the lens between, a 20 mm lens and a 100 mm lens, I will be shocked beyond shocked. And the difference between, what kind of image those two lenses will produce, has a very large effect on whether or not they're, what the aesthetic value of the image is. With a 100 mm lens, you're going to get a close-up shot, generally, of what you're taking a picture of. A 20 mm lens is a much wider angle, much more expansive view, and police officer driving by isn't going to be able to go like, "Oh, yep, that's clearly a 20 mm lens. He's taking a landscape. That's okay." Versus he's taking a close-up picture of, I don't know, something on the shore. For one, it's just not a reasonable determination for a police officer to make. Secondly, I don't think they can make an accurate determination of essentially whether it's being used for artistic merit or terrorism purposes, which is really what they're getting at here. Secondly, from the Fourth Amendment point of view, there's a difference between, just asking for somebody to identify themselves and, taking their ID or physically detaining them, saying that they can't move or, bringing them into the station. If they're bringing them into the station, if they're actually seized by the police officer, where, subjectively and objectively they are not free to leave the situation, then you really have some strong Fourth Amendment implications here.
Right, and I think the other half of this, like what you just noted, which would be, does the photographer then have a claim for false imprisonment or something along those lines? And that's although this is codified in some states, it's generally a common law cause of action for being confined or restrained in a bounded area with intent by another person. And in this case, I think it would ultimately depend on whether the officer actually had a legal right or the legal ability to detain a person for taking photographs or however the officer might describe it. And in this case, I think it would be a reasonable suspicion of criminal activity, which is what the policy mandates the standard to be.
Okay, so in the end, there's a reasonable policy that's based on a reasonable suspicion of criminal activity, not how it was widely reported that police officers can just go ahead and throw any photographer in the squad car if they don't think they're, the picture they're taking is, a pretty picture.
Yeah, and I think it's fair to say that this isn't an outlier case. This doesn't sound like it was terribly egregious or unreasonable. In the past, not recently, I have been stopped before by police officers asking what I was doing in a particular area in Boston, during normal hours of the day, although there were events going on. I think it was the World Series in 2007. And they asked to see my driver's license because I said, "Oh, I live nearby." And they said, "Okay, well, do you have identification to prove that?" And from the moment that I handed my license over to the officer, it was very clear that I was not allowed to leave the area until they were done doing whatever it was that they were doing. And there is sort of a sense of being detained. And I guess the other point that I would make is that since this wasn't terribly egregious, think about what might happen if the case was more significant. And some of the past reports from other areas in the country, there's actually another case in California that happened, and another one in New York, where people were taking pictures of things in the public transportation system. In those cases, and I can't remember which one, in one of those cases, I think one person was more than just detained, but actually like asked to either sit in a squad car or taken aside by a series of officers, and I believe that fingerprints were taken and all sorts of information was noted down. And I think some of this relates back to what the Long Beach Police Department's policy is, and it ties back into what they call suspicious activity reports. The Long Beach Police Department now documents any activity which an officer believes may reveal a nexus to foreign or domestic terrorism. And as part of this, it includes photographs with no apparent aesthetic value.
Yeah, again, my worry there is relying on police officers to make a determination as to whether or not a photograph has aesthetic value. That being said, I'm a photographer. I've been stopped by never police, but security officers asking me to stop taking photos when I was standing in a place that was open to the public. And as a photographer, you roll your eyes at it and you walk away typically. It's not worth putting up a fight. At least in my experience, the reason why O'Brien was probably stopped is because he looks like Riff Raff. You can't tell that over the phone, over the podcast here, but he does.
Thanks for that. Yeah, and I totally lost my train of thought too.
Sorry, that's what I do. What was I
Oh,
talking about?
no, I know. So I mean, the point that I was gonna make there was just that this is sort of the trade-off, I guess, in the post 9/11 world. We are sort of trading in some small bits of our rights, even though who knows what's really changed, but people are more likely, it seems, to ask questions now when it looks like you're doing something that might be suspicious. I mean, I don't really think of photography as a suspicious activity, but if the context is suspicious enough or if it makes somebody uncomfortable, they're more likely to ask questions now. So even if you had, like you noted, like if you were standing in a completely public area when you were taking the photographs, you had every right to be there taking those photographs. No one can stop you from doing that. Yet the person, asked you what you were doing there and then asked you to leave, and you did so. So it just seems like that's a little bit of our right there that we're just lost a tiny bit.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you. I don't like it, but I don't disagree with you
Because
either.
it's not easy to fight. It isn't easy. Who really wants to file a lawsuit over something like that?
Yeah, and the way the policy is phrased, I don't know what standing I don't think the lawsuit would be successful. If they're only detaining people with a reasonable suspicion of criminal activity, that's what the Supreme Court says you can detain people over.
What makes this case also the case that we've been talking about a little bit different is that this guy was actually a journalist, but he was not there on journalistic duties. He was just taking these pictures for artistic purposes, as he stated. But if he had been there for journalistic activities, and the occasion had gone so that the officer maybe asked him to hand over the SD card in his camera or something, then you might have an issue of prior restraint, and it's like the one scenario I could see where you might get standing.
Right. I mean, if he was asked to hand over the SD card, it would have been a seizure of property without due process, without any type of without a warrant. So yeah, that alone would have triggered, something that was suable.
If even if he hadn't done that, I guess if you just asked him to stop and go away after being detained, that would probably be enough for prior restraint
Yeah,
standing.
you can argue that that's a prior restraint. You could also argue that it was a prior restraint if the guy was just doing art and not necessarily if it was journalism, because art gets, pretty much the same First Amendment protection as journalism does.
Right. There are some federal laws that are kind of similar to this. There is this very old Espionage Act, which I think was initially enacted in the early 1900s, maybe 1913, 1915. It said 18 U.S.C. Section 793, and it very broadly prohibits obtaining information respecting the national defense or with intent or reason to believe that the information is to be used to the injury of the United States. And of course, part of that includes photographs. And there's a whole list of places that you basically are not really allowed to obtain information with that particular intent.
That doesn't strike me as constitutional.
It's very old, and I don't know that it's been used anytime recently.
Yeah, I mean, the law that they're trying to get Julian Assange under is essentially possession of information that's classified, regardless of how you got it or what you intend to do with it, is a felony. It's essentially treason. And if that law were ever enforced, for one, it was never meant to be enforced against the press. Whether or not you consider WikiLeaks the press is, up to you. But the law is just, I mean, every day some sort of confidential information is leaked one way or another, in the press. So it's just, it's not a reasonable law to enforce that way.
So, before we sign off here, any final thoughts on this? What I mean, the reporter in this case, it's worth noting, has said that he's not really, or he has no intent to pursue any legal actions against the police department, but it is still kind of an interesting story.
Yeah, I'll just say that this is something that we're going to have to keep an eye on. There's been more and more people cracking down on photographers, to the extent that, some photographers have moved to less powerful, less assuming cameras, moving away from their digital SLRs that you see, around every tourist neck these days, which is kind of funny that tourists can get away with using digital SLRs, but professional photographers are getting more and more grief for it. But it's something that will, photographers and concerned citizens will have to keep their eye on to make sure that this doesn't go too far.
Yeah, agreed. And I also think that photography is one thing, and it's definitely something that needs to remain protectable. But also interesting is what's happening with the surveillance laws and wiretap laws, even in our state, and capturing audio or video streams or both at the same time. And that's something that various law enforcement agencies seem to be cracking down on, at least in our state. And I'm sure that is happening elsewhere too, for not having consent to take video or audio capture of somebody. And on that note, we'd like to thank you for listening to this week's show. And as always, you can find our blog and podcast on the web at technicallylegal.org, on Twitter as @techlegal, and feel free to send us comments and story suggestions to podcast@technicallylegal.org. Signing off, I'm David O'Brien.
I'm Ben Snitkoff.
We'll see you next week.